Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Minister who's been in a coma since January has reportedly suffered a serious setback in his health. This as a ceasefire begins to take hold on Israel's northern border with Lebanon, and Prime Minister Ehud Olmert's government faces challenges from its coalition partners over just how the fighting with Hezbollah has gone. With us live from Israel is Gideon Litchfield, the Jerusalem correspondent for The Economist magazine. And Gideon, first, what is the latest on Sharon's health?
Well, they're talking about an infection in both his lungs, deterioration in his brain condition, and also urinary infection or some other urinary problem. But it's not the first time that he's suffered a deterioration since he went into a coma. They have treated him before, and they say they're going to try and treat him again with antibiotics. Mm. Yes.
Well, I was wondering, during these past several weeks of war with Hezbollah, he, of course, has been out of the news reports here, but have people there been invoking his name?
Not very much. Every so often somebody will stand up and say that if Ariel Sharon was still prime minister, he would have done things differently. He wouldn't perhaps have responded in this aggressive way that Israel did to Hezbollah's provocation. He would have been more sure of himself. He wouldn't have felt the need to prove himself militarily. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, he is gone from political life and he's gone from the scene.
We understand some other Israelis have been saying that Hezbollah wouldn't have been so bold if Sharon were on the scene. But the current Israeli prime minister, Ehud Olmert, has faced a lot of criticism for the way he's waged this war against Hezbollah. He responded to some of the criticism in what seems like a remarkable speech in the Knesset today. He was heckled by three Knesset members, saying he said, in effect, that the war, saying it had eliminated the state within a state run by Hezbollah, but also admitting deficiencies, his word, in the way the war was conducted, saying that Israel would do better another time. It seems like a remarkable acknowledgement that it did not go as well as it might have.
It would have been hard not to admit that things went differently from what everyone was expecting. I think the expectation at the beginning by the generals and by the politicians was that there would be this short, sharp air campaign that would cause the Lebanese to give up and to rein in Hezbollah, and that would be it. And when that didn't work, they had to send in troops. When that didn't seem to do the job, they had to send in more troops. And I think there is a feeling that they've handled that badly, and also probably that they haven't explained themselves too well. So now he's trying to make up for that feeling, but the coalition is bound to be under some kind of stress, in particular because it raises questions about where Olmert goes from here. Will he be able to carry out his convergence plan, his withdrawal of settlements from the West Bank?
And what is the thinking? What will the political fallout be? And in fact, does the possible imminent death of Ariel Sharon have anything to do with that?
I think Sharon's imminent death, or whenever it happens, will not really have any effect. His absence has already been factored into to Israeli politics. Mm-hmm. The implications of the war in the longer term, it's a little early to say still. Lots of people are saying that the withdrawal from the West Bank is now effectively dead, that Olmert won't have the credibility to carry it out. It's early, as I said, it's early to tell. It would have been a very difficult thing to do, even in the best of circumstances. Mm. It was by no means a done deal. On the other hand, there isn't an obvious challenger to Olmert right now. Amir Peretz, the Labour leader who was his strongest contender, is, if anything, more damaged by the way this war has been run than Olmert is, because he's the defense minister.
Mm. Well, Gideon Litchfield, we have just about a minute here. I know you've just driven back from Israel's northern border. Aside from a few small skirmishes that we are hearing about, is the ceasefire that was instituted early this morning, is it holding?
It seems to be, and there have been no rockets from Hezbollah into Israel. I was staying on the border last night in a kibbutz that's about a mile from the border, and the shelling from Israeli artillery into Lebanon went on all night, and then at 8 o'clock in the morning it stopped. Mm. And everybody in the north has been remarking on how quiet it is now that they can't hear the artillery fire. So apart from these skirmishes, it's been quiet. The Israelis say that the soldiers have orders not to fire on any Hezbollah people unless they're actually directly threatened. And apart from one or two cases where that seems to have happened, everything has been quiet.
Gideon Litchfield, Jerusalem correspondent for The Economist. Gideon, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And now to Baghdad. At least 47 people are dead, 100 injured in a predominantly Shiite neighborhood. Iraqi officials blame rockets and bombs from Sunni insurgents, but U.S. officials say they found no evidence of that and that it might have been a natural gas explosion. Well, at any rate, as violence continues, President Bush meets with the Secretary of Defense and experts on Iraq at the Pentagon today. Earlier this month, the top U.S. commander in the Middle East warned for the first time that sectarian violence could plunge Iraq into civil war. Well, Time magazine recently painted a rather disturbing picture of the Iraqi capital in a lengthy article entitled Life in Hell, a Baghdad Diary. In it, the magazine's veteran Baghdad correspondent describes returning to the Iraqi capital after a month off, starting with what he calls the world's scariest plane landing, a steep corkscrewing descent to Baghdad airport that could serve as a metaphor for how things are going in Iraq. Operation Ghosh is Time magazine's Baghdad correspondent. He goes by the name Bobby. He joins us on the line from Baghdad with more. Bobby, welcome.
Hi, Robin.
What a tale you tell. And by the way, on that flight back into Baghdad, you're reminded of other times where you've had to literally slap somebody because they've gotten so frightened on the plane?
Yes, well, it is a hell of a ride. The only comparison, I think, to people who've not taken that is that it's like coming down on a roller coaster, except you're coming down from 30,000 feet on a very small jet plane into the airport, and some people can lose their cool. And yes, there have been a couple of occasions when there was one occasion I had to slap somebody. I should say that it was on the instructions of the stewardess.
Right, and this, by the way, was a hardened cop. And then, of course, there's the drive down the highway to Baghdad, which we know how dangerous that is, the 8 mile highway of death. And just the little details you give are so revealing. You didn't wear your seatbelt, even though your driver was driving defensively to avoid any firing. Why weren't you wearing your seatbelt?
Well, because no Iraqi wears a seatbelt. So if you wear a seatbelt, that marks you out as a foreigner. And the one thing that you do not want to do in Iraq is to be marked out as a foreigner, because there are kidnapping gangs at large who drive around looking for foreigners to kidnap. So you try to do everything you can to blend in. Now, I am from India, which gives me a little bit of an advantage. My skin tone and my physical appearance is not very different from that of an Arab, so I can pass for a local. I don't listen to my iPod when I'm outdoors. I don't wear my seatbelt. I don't chew gum, because these are things that the average Iraqi would not do.
But otherwise, you pass, as you say. But you mentioned the kidnappings, yeah. And that's your biggest fear. It seems to be the biggest symbol of what's going wrong in Baghdad and in Iraq. You quote a number of maybe 40 kidnappings a day in Iraq. We've heard 26. How do regular Iraqis protect themselves from the kidnappings? What are they doing?
Well, there's not a whole lot you can do. I mean, foreigners, those of us who have the benefit of being backed by large corporations like Time Magazine, we can hire security persons to accompany us when we move around. We travel in two cars, one car acting as a decoy sometimes. We keep changing our routes. The average Iraqi is far more vulnerable than we are. Anywhere between 20 and 40 Iraqis are kidnapped every day. A large number of them are never heard from again. The ransom demands range from tens of thousands of dollars to hundreds of thousands, even in the millions, depending on who the target is.
And as a result, you talk about how many Iraqis are fleeing and the impact of that on Iraqi society.
Absolutely. Many Iraqis were waiting for the end of the school term, which happened in June, and as soon as their kids were done with their exams, they left to places like Jordan and Syria and Egypt and elsewhere. Many Iraqis are traveling within the country. They're running away from hostile neighborhoods. The Iraqi government says that nearly 200,000 Iraqis are refugees. But the greater problem is that of the middle class, which is vanishing as people flee the country. And that, of course, has long-term implication, because when we say the middle class, we're talking about doctors and engineers and university professors.
And those who are staying, the Iraqis who are staying, it feels as if they're being held hostage within their homes. I mean, there's a 9 p.m. curfew. To describe more, you paint a picture of Iraqis kind of going crazy almost in their homes.
Well, young Iraqis in particular are going stir crazy. This is the summer holidays from schools and universities, but it is too dangerous to venture outdoors. The traditional summer recreation, which is, you know, a picnic by the banks of the river, a soccer game in the evening, going out to a restaurant or an ice cream joint in the evenings. None of these things are possible anymore. For one thing, there's the curfew. But quite apart from the curfew, these places have all become dangerous. Wherever large numbers or even small numbers of Iraqis gather, suicide bombers or car bombers have been known to target. So at the end of the day, you stay indoors and the only thing you can do is watch television.
But it's interesting, though. I mean, again, these little details, you point out that they are watching the Oprah Winfrey Show with Arabic subtitles, soap operas. World Cup was big, but that can only go so far. There's so little electricity, 120-degree heat, not enough gas, day-long lines to get gas. And you describe in your coworkers a sort of, I would love you to put a word on the attitude that's developing so that, in fact, when, for instance, you are right in the area of a suicide bomber, your colleague, Wissam, well, tell us what he did. I mean, it's just an unbelievable scene when the suicide bomber was by the kebab stand.
Oh, yes, that was at the entrance of the Green Zone. Just moments before we arrived, a suicide bomber blew himself up at a kebab stand. And as we were exiting the car, the head of the bomber came rolling down the road and stopped at the feet of our driver, Wissam. That's not his real name, by the way, but anyway. He basically kicked the head aside dismissively. It has become so commonplace. Young Iraqis, children even, are used to seeing pieces of human carcass being blown around and are no longer shocked by it.
Aparishim Ghosh, known as Bobby, Baghdad correspondent for Time magazine, has written about these incredible scenes in his Baghdad diary. And it's why, Bobby, you say that the Iraqis that you sit around with on a daily basis are, you know, watching the war in Lebanon, for instance, and just think, that's nothing. Or, you know, you tell them about Americans complaining about gas prices. They're appalled at the rest of the world.
Yeah, they're astonished to hear that Americans are upset by gas prices. Just to put things in perspective, before the war, during Saddam's regime, gas was 1 penny a liter. I'm not kidding. For $1, you could get 100 liters of gas. Today, most people are forced to buy gas in the black market, where prices go up to $1 a liter. So we're talking about a 100-fold increase in a matter of 3 years.
Bobby Ghosh, he's been covering Baghdad for Time magazine for the past 3.5 years. His recent Baghdad diary was called Life in Hell. He'll be back with more descriptions of that life in just a moment. But this note, don't forget, later in the program, travel restrictions in the U.S., some have been loosened. You can bring baby food on board. Some have been tightened. Don't bring the baby teething ring if it has gel. We'll have more of that information for you later in the program. Stay tuned. Much more ahead here and now. For the past 3.5 years, and he's written a diary of what he observed after returning to the Iraqi capital after a month off. The diary is called Life in Hell. He describes some gruesome scenes and a political process that is struggling. We note that today a U.S. military spokesman said there's evidence that Shiite extremists in Iraq may be receiving weapons and training from supporters in Iran, but it's not clear if the Iranian government is involved. But Bobby, I want to ask you, from your observations, what do you think is the biggest problem facing Iraq?
At this moment, the biggest problem is the Shiite militias, and the corollary to that is that the biggest problem is the lack of visionary leadership among Iraqi politicians. There is sort of widespread acceptance that the U.S. has a big role to play in creating some of these problems. But at the same time, it's also clear that the Iraqis will have to find a solution for themselves. I mentioned this in my story that there is no Nelson Mandela figure here. There is no Gandhi. There is no great unifying leader. But sadly, this is a country that needs exactly that kind of leadership. Instead, they have a group of leaders who are narrow-minded and who can't bring themselves to rise above their sect or their territorial or their narrow political interests.
And you give examples of both Sunni, you know, the former majority, and Shia, the current majority, the one that was oppressed by the Sunni minority under Saddam Hussein and is now very much in the leadership. But you give examples of this pettiness on both parts.
Yes, that's right. I went to visit the vice president of this country, who is a Sunni politician, on the day that there was a massacre in a Sunni neighborhood by Shiite militias, and naturally he was very upset. But when I asked him if the massacre might have been a retaliation for a similar attack on a Shiite neighborhood previously, his response was to claim that that attack had been done by the Shiites themselves, and that they were deliberately killing their own people and blaming it on the Sunnis to make the Sunnis look bad. Mm. Nobody can accept that there are bad apples in their community, and if they can't even do that, it is very hard to see where a solution is going to come from.
So here we are. You now have the Sunni insurgents coupled with the Shia militia. And by the way, you ironies abound. You spoke to a Sunni insurgent who made an interesting comment to you.
Yes, that's right. Now that the Shiites are beginning to fight back, and clearly they have numbers on their side, and it seems that they are getting support from Iran, the Sunnis now suddenly feel vulnerable. They are at the receiving end. The balance of terror, if you like, has swung in the other direction. And so ironically, the Sunnis now think that their best hope for salvation or for safety anyway are the Americans, the very Americans that they have despised for 2 years and have fought against. So I've had several discussions with leaders of insurgent groups, and they've, you know, in previous conversations, they've had to say about the Americans was, well, we want to kill as many as we can. Now they're turning around and saying, well, why aren't the Americans protecting our people?
Mm.
So that's one irony of the situation here.
So many details, Bobby. Sunnis who are changing the names from Omar, because Omar is a recognizable Sunni name. Iraqi businessmen who are making a lot of money, but keeping it out of the country because they're so afraid they're going to be kidnapped. So many details. I just want to ask you, what do you think has to happen? What has to happen in order for it not to continue to devolve?
A couple of things. One is that the U.S. has to stay the course here, not for the reasons that the administration seems to be suggesting, but because the U.S. has a responsibility here. A big part of the reason why this country is in this situation today is because the U.S. Didn't manage the after the war as well as it should have, and so there is some responsibility that has to be taken by the Americans. The other thing that has to happen, and this is far more difficult to engineer, is that the Iraqi political leadership has got to grow up. They have to set aside their narrow differences and behave like leaders of Iraqis rather than leaders of the Shiite and Sunnis. Will that happen? Frankly, I'm not holding my breath. After 3 years of declining optimism, I now feel a sense of rising pessimism about the future of Iraq.
Well, and you write about the Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. We mentioned the descent into hell, the arrival by plane into Baghdad, and how that became metaphor for your whole experience there. And you say the expression on his face, speaking to fellow Iraqis about how they have to do just that, we have to get it going here, was the same look on the face of people on the plane with you going into Baghdad.
Yes, he looks like a man cornered, frankly. Al-Maliki, when he became prime minister, had a reputation of being a tough guy. He was a Shiite partisan. And when he became a prime minister, the first couple of weeks, he made lots of promises to crack down on the security situation, to use an iron fist. But gradually, I've seen the look on his face change, and he now looks more and more like a man desperate, like a man with no solutions.
One quick question for you. I know in your byline in the Time magazine article, you ask people to write and ask you questions. I'm just curious, what are they writing you?
People are asking, they want to know a little more details about what life is like in Baghdad. We've got a fairly wide range of questions. We've got, you know, we've even had somebody who had a job offer in neighborhood in Baghdad writing in to find out what that is like. We've had people writing in from the States about U.S. policy and whether U.S. should now get out of here. A lot of questions have to do with that. In fact, a lot of questions have to do with the U.S. exit strategy.
Aparishim Ghosh, he also goes by the name Bobby, speaking to us from Baghdad. He reports there for Time magazine. He's written an unbelievable diary. If you go to our website, here-now.org, we'll help you read it, and also you can perhaps have an email with him or two if you'd like. Bobby, we really appreciate your time.
Many thanks, Robin.
Well, and we just spoke with Bobby Ghosh about the Shia majority in Baghdad. Tomorrow on Here and Now, one professor's view of what he's calling the Shia revival, the unintended consequences of liberating the oppressed Shia in Iraq. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. Much more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program is produced.
At level from critical to severe, meaning a terrorist attack is not imminent, and offering some hope to travelers mired in chaos since an alleged plot to blow up airplanes flying from the UK to the US was thwarted last week. Despite the threat level downgrade, some flights from Britain to the US are still being canceled, and one plane bound for New York returned to London when a cell phone on the plane rang and none of the passengers claimed it. In a moment, more on what U.S. travelers can carry in their carry-on bags. But first, there are reportedly new concerns about other potential plots. British Home Secretary John Reid tells the BBC some two dozen other major terrorist conspiracies are still under surveillance. Roger Blitz is a correspondent for the Financial Times. He's joining us from London. And Roger, that comment from John Reid, other possible terrorist plots as maybe many as 20. Did he elaborate?
He pointed out that there are actually some 70 live counter-terror operations ongoing. He's repeated what he has been saying actually since he came into his position earlier this year, that highly likely that there will be a terrorist attack and an attempt to damage UK and its citizens. What he has to try and explain to people is why has the threat been downgraded. What he's been trying to say today is that this is an intelligence-led assessment. There's been an awful lot of concern over the flying restrictions, which has caused a lot of airlines to get concerned about their commercial positions. And what Mr. Reid said was that was definitely not the reason why terrorist threat has been reduced.
By the way, John Reid has said that he doesn't think that the security, which is, you know, tied Heathrow Airport up in knots, he doesn't think that while he thinks that security is necessary, he doesn't think it's sustainable, which is a worrisome thought.
What he's basically saying is that people accept that, you know, there is a risk when we travel. The amount of security we want, the amount of search we want to go through, that is unsustainable. That's the point he's making there. Yeah.
Well, and while he is saying that there are other investigations into other possible plots going on, does the fact that the terror level has been downgraded, does it mean that they feel they have gotten all the suspects in the imminent plot that was disrupted last week?
That's a very interesting question. I mean, because The initial take from it on Thursday was that the main players had been picked up in this alleged plot. There appears to be some people perhaps on the periphery of the operation that they are looking for. As far as the threat connected with this, that appears to be the reason, or it suggests the reason why the threat has been downgraded. We are effectively back to where we were, last Wednesday prior to this position. Our understanding of whether that is makes us any safer is perhaps rather grimly understood a bit better.
Well, what more do we know about the investigation into last week's alleged plot? We read that Britain anti-terrorism police are conducting what's being described as a major search in a wooded area about 30 miles west of London. Do we have any idea what they're looking for?
Well, the police appear to have found a rifle and a handgun during searches at two addresses connected to the investigation. Some suspicious components appear to have been recovered. One of the addresses was near this woodland area. The extent of this search is going to take many weeks, if not months. They are principally looking for evidence that is going to help them secure prosecutions if and when charges are laid against any of these.
Well, meanwhile, 23 suspects are being held in Britain, 17 in Pakistan, including a man who authorities believe has connections to Al-Qaeda. What do we have any sense of what those connections might be? Money or planning, instructions? What do we know?
Pakistan intelligence officers believe that he was principal in being connected to an Al-Qaeda group near the city of Kandahar in southern Afghanistan. But there appears to be some money trail between between Pakistan and the UK.
And speculation that the money might be coming from a militant group that's also a charitable organization that might have been taking money that it was receiving for aid for earthquake victims and using it for this plot, for buying airplane tickets and such.
I've seen that reported. We are guided not to pay too much attention to that. In as much as that the money trail is relevant, not because of the amount of money that is that it uncovers, but that it gives intelligence officers clues as to who is involved and where they are. The amount of money we are told is in the tens of thousands of pounds. You will recall that the 9/11 operation, one of the remarkable factors about it was that the small amount of money involved. And similarly with the London bombings of last year, again, we are talking about monies of not significant amounts. So whether this charitable organization has been siphoning off money from elsewhere, we don't know. Whether it was simply a front in order to create a money trail don't know either.
Roger Blitz, correspondent for the Financial Times, speaking from London. And before we let you go, we want to ask you about the letter that was sent over the weekend to Prime Minister Blair. It was signed by over 30 Islamic groups and some Muslim members of Parliament, essentially connecting the rise in violence among Muslim youth to British foreign policy, specifically support for the U.S.-led war in Iraq. Home Secretary John Reid had an angry response, saying in effect that foreign policy wouldn't be held hostage to threats of violence. But others also pointed out that there were alleged terror plots as far back as 2000, before the war in Iraq, before 9/11. What might that be?
We're not clear what that is. That literally has emerged very recently.
But there were reports that there was an event in Birmingham, England, in 2000. Do we know more about that?
It is clearly, it was something that I think the police ignored until this current plot uncovered people who are from that area and events that took place in that area. It is a large migrant population, and Birmingham has, like many inner cities in the UK, has been careful about policing those.
Roger Blitz, correspondent for the Financial Times, speaking from London on the investigation into the alleged plot to blow up flights from Britain to the U.S. Roger, thanks for speaking with us.
Not at all.
And still to come today, Jethro Tull. Oh, wait, that's the band. The guy is Ian Anderson, and he's coming up. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, while, as we said, the terror alert has been reduced in Britain and small carry-on bags, books, laptops, and iPods are now allowed on flights out of London, cell phones and liquids are still banned, and more flights out of London were canceled today because of the ongoing chaos at screening areas. British Airways canceled a fifth of its flights. The low-cost carriers Ryanair and EasyJet had cancellations as well. In the U.S., the Transportation Security Administration has eased up on some restrictions, but it's gotten tougher on others. For instance, don't bring your baby's teething ring if it's got gel in it. Khalil Sakakini is travel editor and consultant for GoTravelUpdates.com. He joins us. And Khalil, what is the latest? It's all on the Transportation Security Administration website, by the way, but if, for those who can't see it, what can't we bring on board?
Certainly all liquids and gels, including shampoo, toothpaste, perfume, hair gel, suntan lotion, and I guess the key word is all other items with similar consistency are prohibited from carry-on baggage and the security checkpoint.
Well, it's amazing. The list is so extensive. Gel cap pills, for instance, you can take medication, but not gel cap pills.
That's right. However, people carrying formula is acceptable, and now they just ease it a little bit by saying that liquid medications, they now allow up to 4 ounces of liquid non-prescription medication.
Right. And we read with interest that diabetics can now carry their glucose gel.
Glucose gels.
But you know, lipsticks, I just have to mention lipsticks because, you know, everyone has anecdotes, and we know someone whose lip gloss was seized, but now solid lipstick, yes, mascara, no.
And all aerosols, no.
Right. So it's worth perhaps checking out the Transportation Security Administration website to find out more. But in the meantime, I know you've noticed as a travel writer other issues. What is of concern to you?
Emotionally, I guess, is I happen to see a dad carrying his 2 or 3 year old child, I guess, and I was just looking at the airport, had some business to get done, take care of, and she looked very scared. I mean, there were guys with big black guns and people with dogs, and I'm saying, what do you say to your children about this?
So maybe say something before you get there. And just for the sheer practicality of traveling, we mentioned the cancellations out of London. A lot of Americans use these low-cost carriers within Europe to fly from England to the continent.
Right.
So what are you recommending?
On the 10th, 11th, and 12th, Ryanair had, and I looked at the list, 252 flight cancellations. They're good, though. Their website is very helpful. Ryanair does say, look, if you don't want to travel on another flight because you're anxious or nervous, we will refund your money. And Ryanair does have on its website a link to rebook your flight. The bad news is, with, let's say, for example, 95% of all flights to Spain full, what do you do? When are you going to get that extra flight?
Right. Any suggestions? Or
2 suggestions. Again, Ryanair says they will refund the money if you don't want to take that trip or that flight is not available to you. And I guess my interest is, as we talked about a couple of weeks ago, travel insurance. And what's bugging me a little bit is some insurance companies are saying, well, it wasn't an actual terrorist incident. We're not sure we're going to cover your trip cancellation or trip interruption component of the policy. Hmm. That's more the case in the UK. U.S. travel insurance carriers like Travel Guard are more generous in their terms, and I think they are allowing for the coverages to be in effect because of a terrorist threat.
And Khalil, I just want to ask you briefly about checked luggage. British Airport Security is now allowing small carry-on bags and laptop computers, and they are have been here in the U.S. They were never banned, but people are feeling, well, for ease of getting through security, maybe I should check more things. But then there's the issue of security. We read in, for instance, a Scottish newspaper that they are warning people that there are baggage thieves. What's your thinking?
Yeah, I saw that on the Scotsman at thebusiness.com. It was an interesting point. Crime is already rampant, obviously, but crime is already an issue in airports. And I guess if thieves know that people will be, as you said, for convenience sake, putting their iPods and laptops and jewelry in the baggage, then it's just a logical jump to conclude they might just simply take the bags off the carousel and walk away, which I think will lead people to simply keep their prized possessions at home, which is not such a bad idea anyway.
Khalil Sakakini, travel editor and consultant for GoTravelUpdates.com. Khalil, thanks as always.
Robin, always thank you.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now.
Jethro Tull, he's great man. Oh, if Ian Anderson had a dime for every time he heard that one. Ian Anderson was the flute-playing frontman for the 70s band Jethro Tull, the group named after an 18th-century agricultural reformer. Now, Ian is closer to the age of that sniveling character sitting on a park bench in the song Aqualung, but he's going strong. The symphonic Jethro Tull, with Ian Anderson backed by full orchestra, is on tour in the U.S. this summer and fall, and he joins us now. And Ian Anderson, we're wondering, do you still hop around on 1 foot, flute to the side?
Yeah, well, that's the easy bit. The hard bit is reconciling yourself to what you see when you see a reflection in a shop window, you know, because I always wake up in the morning in a good mood, and I feel okay. It's just when I have to look at myself and think, goodness me.
How old are you? I mean, we've now put you, you know, sort of in an old folks' home.
I'm 4 weeks away from being 59.
Oh, that's nothing.
No, you're quite right. You make me feel better again already.
Well, you are credited with introducing the flute to rock music. You're now considered the foremost, and we think perhaps only, exponent of rock-style flute. When did you hear that possibility? I mean, you were listening to rock and playing jazz, we understand. But when did you think, oh, my gosh, the flute can move over to rock?
Well, I'm like most teenagers then and now. I began playing the guitar. I was about 18, 19 years old. I heard Eric Clapton for the first time. And so I decided to look around for something else to play, preferably an instrument that Eric Clapton couldn't play. And if possible, one that Jimi Hendrix and Jimmy Page couldn't play either. So I settled on the flute because of its shininess, its engineering, and I suppose because, like the acoustic guitar and the mandolin, which I enjoyed playing, it was an acoustic instrument.
Well, since we heard we were going to be able to talk to you, we've had this weird musical tick in the office. We can't get rid of it. It goes from person to person.
Really don't mind if you sit this one out. My words but a whisper, your deafness a shout.
What is that like to have created an immortal musical phrase?
Well, it's an interesting one because I've noticed over the years audiences tend to pick up on it as, or that section of the music where that little refrain is heard. They think of it as being a 2-4 or a 4-4 kind of piece, depending on their...
What do you mean by that? Audiences, how do you know that audiences think of
because
it?
Because of where they clap their hands. And you can see they clap along with it as if it was in a four beat measure or a 2-beat measure rather than threes or sixes, which is what I feel.
But you need shoes are worn at the heels, and your suntan's rapidly peels, and your wise men don't know how it feels to be thick as a brick.
But whatever it is, it's actually simple though it may sound. It does produce a lot of problems for some other musicians to actually play it in time, especially those that have grown up with classical music find it quite difficult to play across the bar lines in a way that I do. Having grown up with blues and jazz, you know, my rhythmic sensibilities are slightly more complex, whereas for classically trained musicians, sometimes these things prove problematic. And I rather like the idea that when I work with orchestras, you know, they have something to teach me every time I go into rehearsal with an orchestra. But I hope I have something to offer them too.
You know, so many rock stars with your stature have done classical. Sir Paul McCartney, Elvis Costello. There was that compilation "Exile on Classical Street" with Steven Tyler, Keith Richards. They picked their favorite classical tunes. What's the draw for you? And is this, you know, something that you've always had a passion for, or one that you've acquired more with age?
Well, my working with classical musicians goes back to 1968. It's embedded in Jethro Tull's music since virtually the beginning. I think, though, for some people, meddling with orchestral or classical forces and resources, there's perhaps a little bit of knowing which knife and fork to pick up for the hors d'oeuvre course. it's a little bit about trying to demonstrate you have some sophistication, that you know your wine vintages. Or having been around classical music since the beginning of my performance, it's one of the areas of music that interests me now as they did then. It's just this year I'm doing rather more of it than I have done in the past.
Oh, we won't give in, let's go, let's begin the past.
Do you mind, sir, if I read a little bit from your biography? It says here, your hobbies include the growing of many varieties of hot chili peppers, the study and conservation of the 26 species of small wildcats of the world, and collecting and using vintage Leica and other cameras. You own no fast car, never having taken a driving test, and have a wardrobe of singularly uninspiring and drab leisure wear.
Yes, I did write all of that.
Is it true?
All of those things are absolutely true. Yes, I'm singularly uninspiring in terms of, you know, both wardrobe and my extracurricular activities. No bungee jumping for Ian Anderson. No caving, potholing, or dangerous sports. No, I just sit and potter in the garden, or take my cats for a walk, or. A lot of my leisure time is actually spent watching and reading about world events and things going on the planet, which preoccupy me more and more as I get older, I guess.
Well, you know, but I'm thinking there are a lot of rock superstars who would give anything to have that life puttering in the garden or walking cats. And I read somewhere else where you said that, and you were almost embarrassed to say it, that you never dabbled in drugs. And perhaps that has something to do with, you know, your the lovely life you seem to be leading now.
Well, not having dabbled them, and I can't tell you whether it does or it doesn't. I've no idea what would have happened if I had dabbled. I've seen what they do to other people, and I have to say I don't always find it particularly endearing, but I've no idea whether they're good or bad. I've just got round to trying it. I've never driven a Formula One race car. I haven't ventured into orbit with a Russian spacecraft or had a homosexual experience. But, I mean, it's not that I'm... You know, I don't rule these things out of my life. Distinct possibilities, I suppose, but just probably growing increasingly unlikely, I suspect, that I will lie in the arms of another man or succumb to the subtle overtones of crack cocaine.
Well, I had no idea the course this interview was going to take, but Ian Anderson, the voice and flute of Jethro Tull, it was a pleasure taking this course with you. Thank you.
I like the bit about lying in the arms of another man. I've never said
that. Where did that come from?
Nice. Jolly good. Bye-bye.
The Symphonic Jethro Tull, performed by Ian Anderson, is on tour in several U.S. cities this summer and fall. For more details, go to our website, here-now.org.
But those who choose to stay will live just one more day to do the thing they should have done. And as you cross the wilderness, there's spending in your emptiness, you really have to pray.
Sometimes you just don't know what they're going to say. Well, same applies to you. As always, we love to hear your thoughts. We want to take a second to remind you that our email address is letters@here-now.org, letters@here-now.org, or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again. Here and Now.
And as you cross the circle line, well, the eyes will greet behind. You're a rabbit on the run.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Shining in the setting sun. Well, do you ever get the feeling that the stories do them real?
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now.